Hello, and welcome to show number 2434 of Eyes on Success, a weekly program covering a wide variety of topics of interest to people with vision loss. I'm Nancy Goodman Torpy.
And I'm Pete Torpy.
The crucial part about failure is to look at dead on and take what you can from it so that you don't repeat your mistakes, and then get yourself together and swing for the fences again.
And we all naturally hope to succeed in any endeavors that we attempt, but that doesn't always happen. And that's what today's show is about.
Hard as one might try, success in achieving one's goals is not always guaranteed. When one misses the goal, however, the question is how one reacts to failure and what one learns from it. We'll talk with Dave Wilkinson about these issues as they relate to his unsuccessful attempt to complete a 3,000-mile cross-country bicycle race. But first, for a tip of the week. This week's tip comes from Dave Wilkinson.
When you travel, a lot of the time when I travel, I find that I'm in an environment where blindness or visual impairment or disability as a whole is not necessarily... People take you for who you are, but there's still that sort of, oh my gosh, sort of thing to it that gets old and boring. What I have found is that nudist or naturist events have very open people who are accepting of virtually everything, and that disability is far less of an issue if you're running around with naked strangers than it is anywhere else I've ever been.
And thanks to Dave's advice, perhaps there will be an influx of visually impaired people at nudist colonies.
You are listening to Eyes on Success. 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 Success.
Let's start by meeting Dave.
Today's guest has been with us a number of times in the past, but he's in a new place these days. And so I thought, Dave, maybe you can introduce yourself and tell us exactly what you're doing these days.
Yes, I am Dave Wilkinson, and I'm thrilled to be on Eyes on Success. It has been far too long, and I've had a bit of a career change since the last time I was here. I am now a senior digital accessibility analyst for Hilton Hotels.
And what does that mean you do for Hilton?
It means that I work on a digital accessibility team that is embedded in many, if not all, facets of the development of software, both on the mobile side of things, meaning the Hilton Honors app, on the computer side of things, so, you know, for your PC and our websites and all that kind of stuff. And also internal software that might be used by hotels for everything from reservations to group bookings to anything you can possibly think of. And I work in conjunction with designers and developers so that everything that we do for my part of the Hilton universe is an equal experience for all. We want all of our customers and all of our clients and all of our hotel staff, whether it's franchises or members of the Hilton corporate community, to be able to perform all tasks equally in an environment that is attractive and is aesthetically pleasing in as many ways as possible.
And that includes you, because you also rely on these accessibility features.
Yes.
And just for background, Dave, I don't remember, have you been blind since birth?
I have. I've been blind since birth. I've been a screen reader user since the DOS days.
Support for Eyes on Success comes from our listeners and corporate sponsors.
For more information about airing promotional items on the show, send an email to hosts@eyesonsuccess.net.
This week's focus topic is Dave Wilkinson's experiences participating in the Race Across America bicycle race and how he dealt with its challenges. The Race Across America website refers to the event as, and I quote, "the world's toughest bicycle race." And it goes on to say why they believe that's true. For 43 years, Race Across America has been challenging ultra cyclists from around the globe to push their physical and mental limits to the farthest reaches. Starting in Oceanside, under one of the longest piers in California, the race spans over 3,000 miles, climbs 175,000 feet, crosses 13 states, and finishes on the boardwalk in Atlantic City, New Jersey. The route travels west to east, traversing three major mountain ranges, crosses four of America's longest rivers, and the Great Plains. Also, passing through such iconic landmarks as the Mojave and Sonoran Deserts, Monument Valley, and the Great Plains. Open to amateur and professional racers in solo, two, four, and eight-person relay teams, there is no other race in the world comparable to the Race Across America. The race has become a global icon, having had over 35 countries represented. Not only has it proven to be one of the most challenging races in the world, but it has become a huge platform for racers to raise awareness and money for charities of their choice. Racers have raised over $2 million per year over each of the past 5 years. The Race Across America is 30% longer than the Tour de France, and racers must complete the distance in roughly half the time with no days for resting. So that is quite a race, and we'll see what happened with Dave as he attempted it.
Well, Dave, today we're going to talk about an interesting story you have to tell. And as you know, the name of the show is Eyes on Success. We generally feature stories of people overcoming barriers and hurdles in their pathway to their goals, and we talk about people's successes. But today's story is going to be a little bit different. You're going to tell us a story that involves something you really aspired toward, but may not have ended the way you expected. Can you tell us a little bit about the event that you were involved in that started this path?
Absolutely. As a little bit of background, I do a lot of endurance sports. I've done well over 30 marathons, which don't necessarily fall into the endurance sports category, but I've started doing triathlons. I do Ironman triathlons, which are a combination of swimming, biking, and running. It's a 2.4-mile swim, 112-mile bike ride, and then you finish it up by running a marathon, which is 26.2 miles. I started doing Ironman triathlons as a response to a broken neck in a car crash in 2017 to bounce back and show that I was moderately invincible. At a certain point with Ironman, you start to think, what's next? Which is a patently absurd question to ask, because those things are hard enough as it is. I was introduced to the concept of Race Across America by a friend one morning after a tethered swim in a lake, practice open water swimming, who mentioned that this was something that might be really painful and difficult to look at. And I was immediately interested.
Many of our listeners may not know what the Race Across America is. Why don't you describe it for them?
The idea of Race Across America is this: it's been ridden for 42 years now. It is a 3,000-mile cycling race that goes from coast to coast in the U.S. This year, it started in Oceanside, California, ended up in Atlantic City, New Jersey. You have under 12 days to finish this thing.
And that means about 250 miles of biking per day.
That is one of the assumptions that I made, and I was wrong, because you're actually under, well under 12 days. When you look at the actual time, it needs to be much closer to 280 or 290. And that was one of the miscalculations that I made. I took 12 days literally as in 12 24-hour days. It's not. It's really a little over 11 24-hour days.
That's a lot of biking in a day.
You get a hell of a lot of biking. And you're looking at cycling in extraordinary circumstances. It was 121 degrees when we were riding through the desert in California and Arizona.
And it was presumably sunny at 121 degrees.
It was very, very sunny. It was hot enough that there is a warning in the literature on this that your follow vehicle needs to make sure that it doesn't park over any type of brush because you'll set it on fire.
Wow.
And I understand that you worked very hard to prepare for this. You knew how difficult it was going to be. You talked about preparing for about a year and spending a lot of time. This was kind of a huge goal of yours to accomplish this.
This was a giant goal. I started training on January 1 of 2022. So I trained for almost a year and a half for this. I rode over 14,000 miles in training. I did various long rides to try to get used to riding in the middle of the night when you're tired, all this kind of stuff. I did a qualifying race where I rode a 444-mile race that you had to finish in under, I think it was 44 hours, that my guide and I finished in 31. I searched for a crew and had a crew of 8 people that were supporting me and my tandem pilot. And part of the thing I should throw in at this point is no blind tandem cyclist has ever completed this race as a solo project, meaning that there was a team of 4 blind cyclists and 4 pilots on tandem bikes who completed this in 2018. But as a team, you're not riding the whole thing. You're swapping out for the strongest legs or for your shift. So you may ride for a couple of hours.
When there's a team of 4, each person only rides a quarter of the distance.
That is correct. Or at least, you know, if you approximate it, you may end up doing more than that. If someone else is not having a good ride, you may ride more than that. But you're riding 800-900 miles.
But you were a team of 2 on a tandem, so you presumably were going to do the whole thing, just the 2 of you.
Right. We were not considered a team. We were considered one bike. So we had to ride the whole thing as 2 parts of one bike, if that makes sense. Because as a team of 2 would mean that you were alternating back and forth.
Did you have just 1 pilot?
Yes.
So you found somebody else who was happy to ride 3,000 miles with you cross country?
Yes.
Well, tell us his name then.
Would love to. Jim Trout. He's a world-class cyclist. He's finished Race Across America twice. He's cycled in 40-some-odd different countries. He is a first-class, world-class cyclist. And to take this on with me was a huge undertaking on his part, and I am forever, eternally grateful.
So it sounds like being a super athlete as you were to begin with, and then training specifically for this event over a year, you were already at the beginning to start this race and gung-ho and felt pretty good about it, I guess.
I felt very good about it. I think looking back on it, I felt overly good about it. There are some things that you don't understand what you're doing until you do them, and this is one of them. And spoiler alert for the people that are out there listening to this, we didn't make it. And second spoiler alert, we didn't make it by a long shot. We made about 1,200 miles. And we're probably lucky to make that. And there are various reasons for that that we could spend. There's probably hundreds of pages of writing that can be put into explaining some of the reasons that we didn't make it. It's also worth noting that we were far from the first people to drop out. I think we were the 9th or 10th bike to drop out. There's only like 20-some-odd cycling teams trying this as a solo project to begin with. So we were not the first to go.
So you started this out in California with great anticipation. You biked over the Rocky Mountains and through all of that and biked through Arizona when it was 121 degrees. And I suppose it was taking its toll. What happened?
We had a number of things. And I should state at the outset that none of what I'm about to go into deflects from the end result that we didn't make it. And one of the things that I emphasize and that I think attracted your attention to this podcast is I'm a huge believer in when you fail at doing something to evaluate what happened, take the positives from it, the negatives, take as much information as you can and evaluate it to make sure that in moving forward, whatever you do in life, you don't make the same mistakes again. With that being said, several things happened. My pilot had significant issues in the heat when we hit the desert, almost from day one. And we lost a lot of time so that he could get cooled down and could continue to ride. We booked a hotel one afternoon where we could just stay for 4 or 5 hours and wait until it got cooler, etc., and do as much riding as we could through the night. We had a flat in the Painted Desert in our follow van, and there was no cell service, and you have to have a follow van with you. You're riding in extreme conditions, and you need to have constant support water, cooling vests, being misted, getting fresh ice water, taking 5-minute air conditioning breaks. You're doing anything you can to survive riding in 120 degree weather. So when our follow van had a flat, we were stuck and we had no cell service and the jack broke in the van that we were trying to replace the tire with. And we had to wait until a car came along that actually had a jack so that we could replace the tire with a spare, which also cost us a couple of hours.
Wow.
We had a number of other things happen. I had a crew member who did not function well under the pressure and honestly just had a break with reality and just was not functioning, which also caused a lot of trouble and problems just in the crew itself. I don't know what the details of that were, and we'll leave it to that crew member to hopefully get the help that they need. But that was unexpected. As we started to lose time, we knew we were going to lose time in the hills. Tandem bikes don't do well going uphill. You're carrying hundreds of pounds of weight. Tandem bikes aren't very flexible. They can't make the quick turns. There's more of it to take uphill. It's the sheer bulk. Tandems are just slower.
That's our excuse. We were always slow on a tandem.
We were great going downhill, but boy, going uphill was really a slog.
Well, we were fast going downhill, but within limits. As the pilot, I chickened out around 40 miles an hour and hit the brakes.
Here's the interesting part about downhill. The assumption that people make is that you can make up for the speed downhill that you lose going uphill. I believe that is false. The reason I believe that is false is there is only so fast you can go. On a regular bike, you can hit 50 miles an hour going down really long downhills. I can do that on a tandem, but I can't go any faster because you've got to be able to control this behemoth. And you've got to be able to make quick turns. You've got to be able to have enough speed scrubbed off that if something comes out in your way and you have to avoid it or stop in a hurry, you have to be able to do it. If we let off the brakes and just let that thing fly, God knows how fast it would go. But we wouldn't be in control. And a wreck going that fast is going to kill you. So you can only go as fast as a lot of the other bikes can go going downhill. And you lose speed going uphill.
Dave clearly has more nerve than I do going downhill at 50 miles an hour without a seatbelt.
Now, it sounds like you had ample reason to call this off after only going a little bit more than a third of the way through the race between the heat and the flat and all the other things that happened. But it must have been a difficult decision at the time, I would guess.
It was a crushing decision. When I put an end to it, and to be very clear, I called it off, and it was the right decision to make. To make up time, we started cutting into our sleep, which was already minimal at 3.5 hours a day anyway. And we started trying to knock off time for that. And we were coming into Trinidad, Colorado, which is right before the fun downhill flats began going through the plains of Colorado into Kansas. And I was exhausted enough that I could be told something and I could feel my brain working to decide if it really felt like doing it. And it became readily apparent to anyone close by, including me, that I was an unsafe rider. I couldn't execute commands in a hurry, and I was putting me and I was putting my pilot at risk. And we came up to a hill, and he said, "We're going to have to pedal hard to go up this hill." And I basically said, "I'm not going to. I'm done." And it was crushing.
What kind of shape was your pilot in? I mean, he was doing everything you were doing, too, having all the same hardships.
He was. Jim was having back problems. We kept having to stop or slow down so that he could stand up, stretch his back. He had had a lot of trouble in the heat. And again, we didn't count on any of this ahead of time. You assume that things are going to work well, and you take every precaution you can, and you come up with every possible scenario you can. I wasn't counting on having a flat in the Painted Desert with no cell service. Jim wasn't counting on having trouble with the heat.
and having to stop 8 hours into the race to become rehydrated and get an IV. These are just things that happen. And one of the things that I took away from this is I now understand the gravity of what can go wrong. There's no way we could have planned for some of the things that happened. There's just not.
You know, people think of the physical exhaustion during events like this and how difficult that is. But particularly going through the heat and the lack of sleep, there's also a mental exhaustion and an effect on your mind.
Your mind gets weird. And it was crushing. This was something I'd worked for a couple of years. I'd gotten sponsors lined up. This is a prohibitively expensive venture. I spent tons of money on this. I put a lot of time into it. I had 8 people and then my bike pilot, my tandem pilot, who had come out to do this with me. And all of a sudden, we're not going anywhere. And that was a horrible reality to face, and it was one of the more traumatizing events of my life. Not to be overly dramatic, but it really was. I assumed going into this that we had a very good chance of making it. I knew a lot of things had to go our way. Very few of them did. And even with that being said, I don't think I understood the brutal conditions that we were going to be riding in the beginning of this course. That first third of the course is the toughest part of this course, and it needs to be given all the respect in the world.
So what do you take away from this experience after it's all done?
Ooh, that depends on the day at this point. I'm glad I did this. I will always be very disappointed that I didn't conquer it. I will be eternally grateful to my pilot and to my crew for putting so much belief and energy and just everything into making this go.
Well, I think that people can't expect to succeed 100% of the time. In fact, some people will say, if you never fail, you haven't tried hard enough. But the real question is, what do you do with those failures? What do you learn from it? And, you know, you still come out with the experience.
You take time to grieve, and failure is a grieving process, and it hurts, and it ought to hurt. Because if the goal wasn't worth going for, and if it doesn't hurt when you don't get it, then it wasn't important enough to you. And so you hurt, you grieve, you take care of yourself, you allow others to take care of you. My wife has done a fabulous job of sort of keeping me going through all of this. And at a certain point when you can, you evaluate what went wrong. You give yourself credit for the things that worked. You take a hard look at what didn't work. You evaluate why it didn't work, if it could have been done differently. And if it could have been done differently, you look at why it wasn't done differently. And a lot of that will come down to things that you simply don't know. The crucial part about failure is to look at dead on and take what you can from it so that you don't repeat your mistakes. And then get yourself together and swing for the fences again.
Well, that's a good attitude. It sounds like you're not afraid to make an attempt at something like this again.
I would argue that we are on this earth once, and you better make the most of it because you're not coming back. And if you've only got one shot at something, you better damn well make the most of it. And that's just the way that I view life. This is a one-shot deal, and I intend to get the absolute most out of my time on this planet as I can.
So do you have another challenge lined up?
I have been forbidden from thinking about long-term challenges. I do have a half and full Ironman coming up in the next couple of months. So that will keep me busy. So right now we're focused on a half Ironman and a full Ironman and taking my wife on a much deserved vacation for our anniversary in September.
Great.
Sounds good.
Thank you.
You are listening to Eyes on Success. 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 Success.
Now for this week's final item, how to learn more about the Race Across America, about Dave Wilkinson's participation in it, and how to contact him and them.
Well, Dave, if people had questions for you or they wanted to learn more about you and your experiences, where would they find out some of that information?
My website is speedyturtle.net. That's speedyturtle.net. You can email me at Dave, D-A-V-E, at speedyturtle.net. And I would love to hear from you.
And if, after hearing your description of this race, anybody else wants to learn more about it and maybe even do it, where would they get information about Race Across America?
They can go to raceacrossamerica.org. I would strongly encourage you to look at past riders, find them on social media, and message them and talk to them individually. You cannot get enough information about what you're heading into with this. The logistics are incredible. This is not for the faint of heart. You are going to want to consider things like funding. I think our total budget for this, we probably spent about $40,000.
Wow.
This is not something that you are going to wake up one morning and decide that would be fun. So take it carefully and put a lot of thought into your plan.
In addition, you can find many real-time posts from Dave about his experiences in the race on Facebook, where you search for Speedy Turtle Races Across America.
And of course, if you missed any of that, you can just click on the show notes for this episode, which is episode 2434, at www.eyesonsuccess.net, and you'll find all that information there.
That's it for today's show. Next week on Eyes on Success, we'll be talking about AI-generated video descriptions using PickyBot. There are several artificial intelligence tools that vision-impaired people can use for describing scenes and photographs to assist in their daily lives. PickyBot is unique, however, in that it also has the ability to describe video content. We'll talk with Martijn van der Spek, developer of the app, about how it works and its many customizable features. And if you use an English-based screen reader, you may have heard it referred to as PixieBot.
Thanks for joining us this week, and we hope you'll join us next week for that episode.
You've been listening to Eyes on Success, hosted and produced by Nancy Goodman-Torpy and Peter Torpy.
You can access the full archive of previous shows, subscribe to the podcast, and much more by going to our website, www.eyesonsuccess.net. If you have questions about anything you've heard on the show or have suggestions for future shows, send an email to hosts@eyesonsuccess.net.
Thank you for listening, and have a nice day.